This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Our third and last presentation for the morning is by Gregory Flaxman. And Greg's a doctoral student in the program of comparative literature and literary theory here at the University of Pennsylvania. Last year, he published an edited collection from Minnesota Press entitled, quote, "The Brain is the Screen, Deleuze and the Philosophy of Cinema." He's currently at work on a project addressing the relationship of art and complexity theory in science. And Greg's piece today will be on, quote, "Oswaldo Romberg's Periodic Table."
First of all, let me thank Aaron and Jean-Michel for inviting me to come talk. This is a really great opportunity, at least for me, to begin to work through a number of things. And maybe I've worked through them a little too much at the beginning, because there are going to be a couple pages that seemingly have nothing to do with Oswaldo Romberg. But I promise you there's a payoff, and if there's not, you can tell me so. First of all, it's interesting because there are significant connections with the two previous speakers. The first is that I completely agree there's something about the entropy of this kind of work, or even fatigue, and I'd actually like to use a word. I won't speak at all about Deleuze, but the word I would use is épuisement, which is this exhaustion that you get a feeling of. Do I need to talk to it? Okay. This exhaustion that you begin to feel in the process of dealing with Oswaldo's work. In some sense, it has to do with failure. And I think that the reference to Deleuze is important because while I'm not going to talk about Deleuze, it really does inform the nature of this kind of intellectual and artistic labor. Now, for the paper itself, I have a feeling when I look through Oswaldo Romberg's work that it's a sense of vastness, because not only are there so many different projects, but the size of the projects themselves, there's this sense of just absolute immensity. And I think in a way it's most apparent for me in one of the more recent projects, which is Plus 2000 Minus 2000 Even, an installation at the end of the millennium, in which the artist confabulates a vast filigree of collages, each of which juxtaposes images and text from wholly different eras, locations, and cultures. Now, I don't think we have any slides of this, but if you look through any of the materials, it's this really amazing kind of installation where you have all these sort of reflected images and their silhouettes, etc., all brought together, and apparently you're always wondering, well, what's the connection between these images? And there is a connection, but I'll get to that. The retrospective nature of this work encourages, as many critics have noted, a revaluation not only of art history, but of history itself. In the words of Jorge Luis Borges, words that Romberg himself solicits, quote, "Perhaps universal history is nothing but the history of a few metaphors," unquote. But how can we unveil the metaphors of history, and how can we demystify the nature of chronology? And it's that second question that I'm really interested in. Romberg's answer is woven through his entire oeuvre, but in the spirit of Plus 2000, Minus 2000, we might begin to take the idea of the millennium itself as a point of departure, and that's what I want to do. I want to talk for just a couple minutes about the question of a millennium. It shouldn't be hard for us to remember how, I think it's like 15 months ago, the year 2000 loomed before us, the subject of a countdown that, however improbably, held the threat or promise of a genuine event. We all recall how the worries over the Y2K problem and how they've been advertised, how speculation ranged from predictions of personal computer glitches and ATM failures to, you know, massive foul play, nuclear mishap, whatever. In its most menacing formulation, the year 2000 acted as a kind of strange attractor for our anxieties, drawing together wholly different planes of thought, systems of discourse, and narrative trajectories. Above all, the phantasmatic beauty of the year 2000 managed to bring science into an orbit with other seemingly unrelated forces in such a way as to test the most basic metronomic sense of historical time. And that's the sense in which I think that it's crucial that this is a project for the millennium. In discussions of the millennium, the so-called, quote, worst-case history, unquote, considered by scientists, which is basically nuclear apocalypse, echoed a litany of biblical prophecies that fundamentalists regularly dwell upon in order to predict Armageddon, the second coming of Christ, and the endgame of final judgment. Hence, while technocrats feverishly work to anticipate and correct the problems caused by the Y2K bug, etc., religious fanatics hailed those problems as the foreordained unfolding of a chiolistic narrative that promised to bring an end to life on earth as we know it, revealing once again the kingdom of God from which man, however temporarily, had been exiled. Indeed, and this is important, the Greek root of apocalypse means revelation or unveiling. But how, we might ask, does the invocation of such an event around the millennium bring us any closer to understanding Osvaldo Romberg's project? Among the multiplicity of collages that make up plus 2000 or minus 2000 even, one particular image I want to talk about is composed of a Xerox woodcut. It's a Xerox, and it's called Lutero Preaching, and it's set next to an image taken from Francis Bacon's Study of the Human Body. And what's amazing to me is that you have these two images sort of juxtaposed, and then the text of the collage, which is labeled Burgundy 1033 AD, or rather ACE, I suppose you'd say, it reads this, quote, "Many people here believe that this year, the 1,000th anniversary of the death of Christ, is the year that will mark the end of the world. Their beliefs are not new. 33 years prior, a good part of the Western world was gripped by a sort of fear for the passing of the millennium. Huge crowds are now making public displays of repentance, and thousands have gone on pilgrimages to the heart of the Holy Land." Now, we look back on this episode, and 978 years later, as if it were a ripple in the fabric of time that we, somehow further from the epicenter, whether it's Christ or whatever, have felt again, but perhaps no differently. The very numerological schemes that were used to mark the significance of the first millennium, or 1033 AD, for that matter, are still used by modern Seventh-day Adventists, who were, if you don't know this, the Seventh-day Adventists were the people that that brought us David Koresh, essentially, Jehovah's Witnesses, and others. And they all return to this basic passage from the Old Testament, from the New Testament, from Revelation 20, which reads as follows. St. John's vision. "I saw an angel come down from heaven, and he laid hold on me, Satan, and bound him up 1,000 years, and cast him into a bottomless pit, and shut him out, and set a seal upon him. And I saw the souls of him, I saw the souls that were beheaded for the witness of Jesus, and they lived and reigned with Christ 1,000 years. And it's that number, 1,000 years, that people have picked up on again and again and again. The problem is, if we regard this as a prediction, the question is, you know, when does 1,000 years actually begin? How do we manage to work out the chronology or the counting so as to know or predict apocalypse? In the Gospels, Jesus actually says at one point, you know, "I'm going to come back in your own lifetimes." He tells us, you know, the apostles, "I'm going to come back." And obviously he doesn't come back. So this is incredible sort of exegetical task. You know, how do you number the years? And how do we know which year he'll come back? Well, in some cases, you turn the days that he says he'll be gone into years. So 1,000 days becomes 1,000 years, etc. And the problem with all of this is that it all has to be aligned with, I guess, three or four major realignments within the Western calendar, not just the Gregorian calendar, but before that there are other realignments. So all of this has to be sort of configured together. So how is it decided that the year 2000, which is to say last year's 2000, would assume significance? Naturally, the basic decision is supposed to echo Christ's birth, and yet the number 2000 is essentially arbitrary, and I think this is really the point when we're getting to dealing with Romberg's work. If Christ's birth marks the first year ACE, the new millennium technically began in 2001. The numerology of the Bible is sufficiently baroque to determine a practically infinite number of other possible revelation dates. but the fact is that the appearance of a clean number, this sense of being poised on the cusp of a new regime, 2000 rather than 1, however silly that sounds, this long tail of zeros secures our faith. Indeed, our passion for this signifier, 2000, returns us back to the primal scene of our seduction by an Arabic base 10 system, in which a string of zeros evokes a kind of roundness or perfection, what Bertrand Russell once said of mathematics, he called it a cold and beauty, a beauty cold and austere. And there's something about this number that you know gives us this sense of a perfect roundness, and that attracts us. In this sense, however, the whimsy that we attribute to apocalyptic predictions is applied with equal justification to the millennium bug or Y2K problem, which arose from the capricious decision to use only two digits to mark the calendrical date on computers, so that when you got 2000 rolled around, the double zeros would be read as 1900. Indeed, whenever it officially began, and because we don't even know when it officially began, the millennium marks a moment so arbitrary as to undermine the entire credibility of calendrical or chronological time. And this is the sense in which Romberg's project and its image of history ought to be understood. Plus 2000 minus 2000 even is not a work of the millennium, but a meditation on millennialism, and all attempts to determine a quantifiable, numerable, or successive sense of history. The millennium is not the cause of the installation, but rather what Kierkegaard might call its occasion, the arbitrary moment that moves inclination, and as such is rewritten by history as a moment of signifying significance, or signifiant. In the case of Romberg's work, however, this occasion marks a paradoxical juncture, because the particular moment, which is annotated within a chronologic of moments, also provokes the evacuation of calendrical meaning altogether. We might take the title of the installation, plus 2000 minus 2000 even, to mean this, give or take a couple thousand of years. For what is the meaning, ultimately, of 2000? Or why is 2000 inherently more valuable than any other number? Perhaps universal history is nothing more than the history of a few metaphors, for the revelation incurred by the millennium is that no millennium as such exists, that our best attempts to enumerate, encode, and determine are ultimately human illusions. And in the time remaining, I want to explain why this structural paradox seems to me to be one of the keys to understanding most of, or a good portion of, Oswaldo's works, especially the earlier ones, the 1970 pieces. If you have any time to sort of to look through the body of Romberg's works, I think that what strikes me, at least, is a passion for classification and for codification. And I think you see it in his earliest works with landscape. You can put this one on. And his works with color, to his works on classical art, his sort of analyses of classical art, which have already been mentioned, to his burning library, which is one of the most fascinating images I can think of, and finally to the Millennial Project. So all of them revolve around modes of categorization, classification, compartmentalization, and taxonomy. As in plus 2000, minus 2000, Romberg's earlier work draws even more explicitly upon various ordering systems, but to what end? Now take, for instance, this slide, which is from Analysis of a Landscape, number one, which was first exhibited in 1972. Here, Romberg takes a generally romanticized tradition of representation, namely a landscape, and what might specifically have been a sublime photographic image, and submits them to a classification of color and texture. And if you look closely, it really is not just color that's being sort of classified above, but different textures. At first glance, the procedure seems to drain both the genre and the photograph of absorptive power. And we are tempted, as have been many critics, to talk about an artistic labor that subverts the codes of art. Likewise, consider Analysis of the Abduction, in which the Rubens painting ostensibly becomes the object for a kind of semiotic analysis, its colors and tones typologized, its strategies deconstructed. And yet, what is really being exhausted in this image? What is the subject of the assault? We assume that Romberg's is a critique of art historical codes, but is this really the case? And I think not, actually. Much has been made by a number of critics about Romberg's structuralist impulse, especially his relationship to the work of Roland Barthes. And so let us take Barthes' own lesson to heart. I don't know how many people have read SZ, but in this book, what Barthes basically does is he takes a story by Balzac, Sarrasine, and he tries to decode or encode the entire book according to specific categories that he's devised. And I would ask, is SZ, this book, simply a critique of the codes of realism, or does it also, and perhaps ultimately and more definitively, exhaust the whole process of coding, decoding, and ordering? And I'd say the test of this is, for whoever's actually read this book, I don't believe you've actually gotten through it. You know, I mean, is it possible to get through SZ? And is there a point in getting through SZ? Because at a certain point, the process exhausts itself, and you don't need to read anymore because you get it. In the same sense, while Romberg highlights and thereby subverts the codes of classical painting, I would suggest that this is an effect of a more profound project, namely to exhaust classificatory and taxonomic methods. In other words, the subject of analysis of the abduction is the very enterprise of analysis, the prototypically scientific effort to reduce an object to its constituent parts, which, I don't need to tell you, Rubens' painting absolutely exceeds. So how does one produce the effect of exhaustion? This is what I want to talk about in the 2 minutes that I have left. Perhaps we can grasp Romberg's work here and elsewhere as performing a kind of reductionism in the sense in which physicists use this term. The traditional path of quantum mechanics has been to search for ever smaller constituents that compose our universe, from atoms to neutrons, protons, and electrons that compose atoms, to the quarks and muons that compose electrons, and so on. It's an endless game. I promise you it'll never end. Likewise, Romberg has undertaken a scientific strategy that ostensibly attempts to reduce art to its most basic elements. But as the subject of his own art, this strategy is staged to exhaust itself. Isn't there always something smaller and more basic? And if so, does its particularity remain subsumable to recognizable categories and rubrics? Do you want to show the third one? Let's take a look. This is actually probably my favorite work of Romberg's, Blue Desaturation, it's called. This remarkable painting stands as one of the paragons of Romberg's classificatory compulsion, revealing, as it does, a vast grid in which the artist has tried to adduce the most basic and discrete possibilities of a single color, as if there could be a periodic table of blue. Indeed, each of the 152 color samples appear discrete, tending towards some level of desaturation or coloration, inclining to brown or green, dark or light. But the problem is that the more the samples proliferate, the more we analyze the spectrum of color, the more we realize that that these are not constituents of blue or even possibilities of blue, but singularities. They're events of blue that the classification makes possible at the cost of its own consistency. Now let me try to explain that. The determination of samples as blue renders the univocal concept blue virtually meaningless. So you have the signifier, blue, and it's supposed to mean all these things, but this multiplicity exceeds any signification. What fails then is not the project to produce a periodic table of blue, which is to say that multiplicity, because it's right there, but rather the unifying or totalizing power of its signifier. Indeed, we should understand Romberg's title, Blue Desaturation, to mean that the desaturation is undertaken not with regard to the color, which color, we might ask, because there are 100 blues, but to the signifier itself. It's that word that's being desaturated. And the word is desaturated of substance. It's diffused or diffused of its coherence. And I think that this is the process that I really appreciate in Romberg's work, this insistence on undraining and on exhausting methods. In this respect, Romberg's work often brings us to the point of saying, what is a taxonomy after all? What is a category of a color or the unity of a year? You know, how do we come to these measuring sticks? Far from being an objective quantification, a taxonomy always begins with a process of selection, with a personal bias that spurs the so-called order of things. We all recall the taxonomy of a certain Chinese encyclopedia that Borges invents, a taxonomy in which, and this is a quote from Borges, animals are divided into A, belonging to the emperor, B, embalmed, C, tame, D, suckling pigs, E, sirens, F, fabulous, G, stray dogs, H, included in the present classification, I, frenzied, J, innumerable, K, drawn with a very fine camel hair brush, L, etc., M, having just broken the water pitcher, N, that from a long way off look like flies. And this is the crazy sort of taxonomy that Borges gives, but it's indicative, I think, of what's going on in Romberg's work as well. However silly it may sound, the list enumerated here begins to suggest the subjective nature of any classification. Certain categories seem perfectly sensible, for instance, suckling pigs, and we might even note, as Foucault once did, that it's not that you know, there are fabulous animals mixed up with, you know, perfectly normal ones. The fabulous are themselves given a category, the fabulous animals. That's not what screws up the taxonomy. The derealizing force of this list does not lie in fantastical or mythical creatures. Rather, what upsets the logic of the taxonomy is the way these categories interact, overlap, and undercut one another, including or excluding, pushing the rationality of the undertaking toward a point of nonsense. What do we make of a list of animals that includes the very category animals included within the present classification? It makes no sense. Such a taxonomy brings the scientific pursuit of order to the point of derealization. Similarly, it strikes me that Romberg's classifications, however sensible they seem, are really somehow simulacra of scientific approaches that finally impose upon us the revelation that science itself is a simulacrum, an invention, an artifice, and no better than art. Thanks.